Thanks for tuning into the podcast. Before we start the show, I want to let you know something. My latest novel, Personal Fable, is free for the next few days. So if you're hearing this ad, it's currently free if you're a Kindle user. So just look it up on your Kindle. If you don't have a Kindle, you can even get one of those for free by getting the free Kindle app on your phone. And then head over, get Personal Fable, have a read, and if you love it, leave a review. And I hope you love the story. Now, let's get on with the podcast. P.S. The promotion runs the 11th, 12th, and 13th of March. Welcome back to another episode of A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero. And I'd like to say hi to the new listeners. I've noticed a bump in listeners by about 10 listeners per day. But the weird thing about this podcast is when people start to listen to it, there are, well, at the moment, they're 50 episodes behind. So there's kind of no point me saying today, welcome to the new listeners, because they won't hear this for a while. But still, welcome all the same. I'd also like to thank Instagram user 49books, or 49books. They shouted out the podcast, our Instagram page, which is just at A Year of War and Peace. On their page, which I just thought was so cool because, I don't know, I've never done something that someone thought was cool enough to shout out to their own subscribers. So thanks very much for that. Gave me a warm, fuzzy feeling. So at the moment, we're getting about 140 listens per day, approximately. Some days 150. It's getting up there. And I was listening to this podcast, not that I'm trying to go all Napoleon here. I don't want to take over the world. But, you know, a little bit of growth would be awesome. I genuinely feel like people value this podcast, and if we can reach more people, that they can get the same value out of it as well. Plus, I'm an egomaniac who wants to rapidly expand his empire. But anyway, I wasn't listening to a podcast. I was reading on the r/podcasts subreddit, and a very successful podcaster with, you know, thousands of listens per day said that the first subscribers are very hard earned. You have to really work to get the first amount of subscribers, but at a certain point it begins to build itself, and your subscribers will talk, and there'll be word of mouth, and you won't have to do as much to promote the podcast. Another user asked the person, well, if you had to put a number on that, what, how many subscribers did you have when that started to happen? And they said very precisely 150. And they were very blunt, and they just said, yeah, at about 150, I just noticed it took care of itself, and it built and it grew momentum by itself, and it all became much easier. Now, at the moment, I'm getting about that many listeners per day. I don't know if I really would say I have 150 subscribers yet. It's hard to tell because people subscribe on different platforms. Some people have subscribed through iTunes, which I don't really have visibility of that. And some people just listen every day, but they haven't actually used a subscribe function. They just return to the website. I think it'd be a bit less than 150 because I still get quite a few people who are checking it out for the first time. And so the most popular episode, obviously, is the first episode and the introduction episode as well. And obviously, you know, not everyone who checks it out will be for them, but quite often they keep going and they stick with it, which is really encouraging. So, I think I'm just shy of the 150 mark, and what I want to do is ask the listeners, ask you guys, if you have any ideas of how we can get the word out about the podcast and help other people to experience this awesome community. So, my question to you guys, or maybe even my request to you guys, is if you have a literature or a book or a writing blog or a Facebook page or an Instagram account or anything like that, and you would feel comfortable to do a shout out to the podcast, I would be eternally grateful, to put it one way. I'd be extremely appreciative. And the other thing I was thinking to do was to sort of, I guess you call it cross promote, but just to get involved with those other groups, Facebook groups and blogs and stuff like that. And there's heaps of ideas that we could use to sort of expand this thing. And I'm really keen to give it a shot. So if you could, share the podcast to your Facebook friends and to your groups and blogs on whatever you've got, I would absolutely love that. And let me know once you've done it. Tag me or send me a message and let me know, because I'd like to reciprocate and you know, show appreciation for you having done that. And of course, I'd like to stress that you are not at all obliged to help me with that ambition of mine. You're completely free to continue anonymously listening to the podcast and enjoying it. All right, warriors and peacekeepers, shall we do some reading? We're up to book 3 today, chapter 1 of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. And let's jump into it, hey?
Hi.
Hey, how are ya? Apologies, I've got 2 Launchpad members here who've just arrived and declared that they feel like watching cartoons. So they're watching Teen Titan something in the background while I talk to you about War and Peace. What a weird life I live. I apologize if you can hear cartoon noises in the background to this very serious novel. Prince Vasily was not a man who deliberately thought out his plans. Still less did he think of injuring anyone for his own advantage. He was merely a man of the world who had got on and to whom getting on had become a habit. Schemes and devices for which he never rightly accounted to himself, but which formed the whole interest of his life, were constantly shaping themselves in his mind, arising from the circumstances and persons he met. Of these plans he had not merely 1 or 2 in his head, but dozens, some only beginning to form themselves, some approaching achievement, and some in course of disintegration. He did not, for instance, say to himself, "This man now has influence. I must gain his confidence and friendship and through him obtain a special grant." Nor did he say to himself, "Pierre is a rich man. I must entice him to marry my daughter and lend me the 40,000 rubles I need." But when he came across a man of position, his instinct immediately told him that this man could be useful, and without any premeditation, Prince Vasily took the first opportunity to gain his confidence, flatter him, become intimate with him, and finally make his request. He had Pierre at hand in Moscow, and procured for him an appointment as gentleman of the bedchamber, which at that time conferred the status of councillor of state, and insisted on the young man accompanying him to Petersburg and staying at his house. The footnote says that Councillor of State is a less important functionary than the title in English suggests. It was the 5th of the 11 classes in which all officials, civil or military, were ranged. With apparent absent-mindedness, yet with unhesitating assurance that he was doing the right thing, Prince Vasily did everything to get Pierre to marry his daughter. He had thought out his plans beforehand. He could not have been so natural and shown such unaffected familiarity in intercourse with everybody, both above and below him in social standing. Something always drew him towards those richer and more powerful than himself, and he had rare skill in seizing the most opportune moment for making use of people. Pierre, on unexpectedly becoming Count Bezukhov and a rich man, felt himself, after his recent loneliness and freedom from cares, so beset and preoccupied that only in bed was he able to be by himself. He had to sign papers, to present himself at government offices, the purpose of which was not clear to him, to question his chief steward, to visit his estate near Moscow, and to receive many people who formerly did not even wish to know of his existence, but would now have been offended and grieved had he chosen not to see them. These different people, businessmen, relations, and acquaintances alike, were all disposed to treat the young heir in the most friendly and flattering manner. They were all evidently firmly convinced of Pierre's noble qualities. He was always hearing such word as, "With your remarkable kindness," or "Your excellent heart," "You are yourself so honourable, Count," or "Were he as clever as you," and so on, till he began sincerely to believe in his own exceptional kindness and extraordinary intelligence, the more so as in the depths of his heart had always seemed to him that he really was very kind and intelligent. Even people who had formerly been spiteful towards him and evidently unfriendly now became gentle and affectionate. The angry eldest princess, with the long waist and hair plastered down like a doll's, had come into Pierre's room after the funeral. With drooping eyes and frequent blushes, she told him she was very sorry about their past misunderstandings and did not now feel she had a right to ask him for anything, except only for permission, after the blow she had received, to remain for a few weeks longer in the house she so loved and where she had sacrificed so much. She could not refrain from weeping at these words. Touched that this statuesque princess could so change, Pierre took her hand and begged her forgiveness, without knowing what for. From that day, the eldest princess quite changed towards Pierre and began knitting a striped scarf for him. "Do this for my sake, monsieur. After all, she had to put up with a great deal from the deceased," said Prince Vasily to him, handing him a deed to sign for the princess's benefit. Prince Vasily had come to the conclusion that it was necessary to throw this bone, a bill for 30,000 rubles, to the poor princess, that it might not occur to her to speak of his share in the affair of the inlaid portfolio. Pierre signed the deal, and after that the princess grew still kinder. The younger sisters also became affectionate to him, especially the youngest, the pretty one with the mole, who often made him feel confused by her smiles and her own confusion when meeting him. It seemed so natural to Pierre that everyone should like him, and it would have seemed so unnatural had anyone disliked him, that he could not but believe in the sincerity of those around him. Besides, he had no time to ask himself whether these people were sincere or not. He was always busy, and always felt in a state of mild and cheerful intoxication. He felt as though he were the centre of some important and general movement, that something was constantly expected of him, that if he did not do it he would grieve and disappoint many people, but if he did this and that, all would be well, and he did what was demanded of him, but still that happy result always remained in the future. More than anyone else, Prince Vasily took possession of Pierre's affairs, and of Pierre himself in those early days. From the death of Count Bezukhov, he did not let go his hold of the lad. He had the air of a man oppressed by business, weary and suffering, who yet would not, for pity's sake, leave this helpless youth, who, after all, was the son of his old friend and the possessor of such enormous wealth, to the caprice of fate and the designs of rogues. During the few days he spent in Moscow, after the death of Count Bezukhov, he would call Pierre or go to him himself, and tell him what ought to be done in a tone of weariness and assurance, as if he were adding every time, "You know, I am overwhelmed with business, and it is purely out of charity that I trouble myself about you, and you also know quite well that what I propose is the only thing possible." "Well, my dear fellow, tomorrow we are off at last," said Prince Vasily one day, closing his eyes and fingering Pierre's elbow, speaking as if he were saying something which had long since been agreed upon and could not now be altered. "We start tomorrow, and I'm giving you a place in my carriage. I am very glad. All our important business here is now settled, and I ought to have been off long ago. Here is something I have received from the Chancellor. I asked him for you, and you have been entered in the diplomatic corps and made a gentleman of the bedchamber. The diplomatic career now lies open before you." Notwithstanding the tone of wearied assurance with which these words were pronounced, Pierre, who had so long been considering his career, wished to make some suggestion. But Prince Vasily interrupted him in the special deep cooing voice, precluding the possibility of interrupting his speech, which he used in extreme cases when special persuasion was needed. "Mais, monsieur, I did this for my own sake, to satisfy my conscience, and there is nothing to thank me for. No one has ever complained yet of being too much loved, and besides, you are free, you could throw it up tomorrow. But you will see everything for yourself when you get to Petersburg. It is high time for you to get away from these terrible recollections." Prince Vasily sighed. "Yes, yes, my boy, and my valet can go in your carriage. Ah, I was nearly forgetting," he added. "You know, monsieur, your father and I had some accounts to settle, so I have received what was due from the Ryazan estate, and will keep it. You won't require it. We'll go into the accounts later." By what was due from the Ryazan estate, Prince Vasily meant several thousand rubles, quit rent received from Pierre's peasants, which the prince had retained for himself. In Petersburg, as in Moscow, Pierre found the same atmosphere of gentleness and affection. He could not refuse the post, or rather the rank, for he did nothing, that Prince Vasily had procured for him, and acquaintances, invitations, and social occupations were so numerous that, even more than in Moscow, he felt a sense of bewilderment, bustle, and continual expectation of some good, always in front of him but never attained. Of his former bachelor acquaintances, many were no longer in Petersburg. The guards had gone to the front, Dolokhov had been reduced to the ranks, Anatole was in the army somewhere in the provinces, Prince Andrew was abroad, so Pierre had not the opportunity to spend his nights as he used to like to spend them, or to open his mind by intimate talks with a friend older than himself and whom he respected. His whole time was taken up with dinners and balls, and was spent chiefly at Prince Vasily's house in the company of the stout princess, his wife, and his beautiful daughter Helena. Like the others, Anna Pavlovna Scherer showed Pierre the change of attitudes towards him that had taken place in society. Formerly, in Anna Pavlovna's presence, Pierre had always felt that what he was saying was out of place, tactless and unsuitable, that remarks which seemed to him clever while they formed in his mind became foolish as soon as he uttered them, while, on the contrary, Ippolit's stupidest remarks came out clever and apt. Now everything Pierre said was charmant, even if Anna Pavlovna did not say so. He could see that she wished to, and only refrained out of regard for his modesty. In the beginning of the winter of 1805, Pierre received one of Anna Pavlovna's usual pink notes with an invitation to which was added, "You will find the beautiful Elena here, whom it is always delightful to see." When he read that sentence, Pierre felt for the first time that some link, which other people recognized, had grown up between himself and Helena, and that thought both alarmed him, as if some obligation were being imposed on him which he could not fulfill, and pleased him as an entertaining supposition. Anna Pavlovna's "at home" was like the former one, only the novelty she offered her guests this time was not Mortemart, but a diplomatist fresh from Berlin, with the very latest details of the Emperor Alexander's visit to Potsdam, and of how the two august friends had pledged themselves in an indissoluble alliance to uphold the cause of justice against the enemy of the human race. Anna Pavlovna received Pierre with a shade of melancholy, evidently relating to the young man's recent loss by the death of Count Bezukhov. Everyone constantly considered it a duty to assure Pierre that he was greatly afflicted by the death of the father he had hardly known, and her melancholy was just like the august melancholy she showed at the mention of her most august majesty, the Empress Marya Fedorovna. Pierre felt flattered by this. Anna Pavlovna arranged the different groups in her drawing room with her habitual skill. The large group, in which were Prince Vasily and the generals, had the benefit of the diplomat. Another group was at the tea table. Pierre wished to join the former, but Anna Pavlovna, who was in the excited condition of a commander on a battlefield to whom thousands of new and brilliant ideas occur, which there is hardly time to put in action, seeing Pierre, touched his sleeve with her finger, saying, "Wait a bit, I have something in view for you this evening." She glanced at Helena and smiled at her. "My dear Helena, be charitable to my poor aunt who adores you. Go and keep her company for 10 minutes. And that it may not be too dull, here is the dear Count, who will not refuse to accompany you." The beauty went to the aunt, but Anna Pavlovna detained Pierre, looking as if she had to give some final necessary instructions. "Isn't she exquisite?" she said to Pierre, pointing to the stately beauty as she glided away. "And how she carries herself, for so young a girl, such tact, such masterly perfection of manner. It comes from her heart. Happy the man who wins her. With her, the least worldly of men would occupy a most brilliant position in society. Don't you think so? I only wanted to know your opinion," said Anna Pavlovna. And she let Pierre go. Pierre, in reply, sincerely agreed with her as to Helena's perfection of manner. If he ever thought of Helena, it was just of her beauty, and her remarkable skill in appearing silently dignified in society. The old aunt received the two young people in her corner, but seemed desirous of hiding her adoration for Helena, and inclined rather to show her fear of Anna Pavlovna. She looked at her niece as if inquiring what she was to do with these people. On leaving them, Anna Pavlovna again touched Pierre's sleeve, saying, "I hope you won't say that it is dull in my house again," and she glanced at Helena. Helena smiled with a look implying that she did not admit the possibility of anyone seeing her without being enchanted. The aunt coughed, swallowed, and said in French that she was very pleased to see Helena. Then she turned to Pierre with the same words of welcome and the same look. In the middle of a dull and halting conversation, Helena turned to Pierre with the beautiful, bright smile she gave to everyone. Pierre was so used to that smile, and it had so little meaning for him, that he paid no attention to it. The aunt was just speaking of a collection of snuff boxes that had belonged to Pierre's father, Count Bezukhov, and showed them her own box. Prince Helena asked to see the portrait of the aunt's husband on the box lid. "That is probably the work of Vanesse," said Pierre, mentioning a celebrated miniaturist, and he leant over the table to take the snuff box while trying to hear what was being said at the other table. He half rose, meaning to go round, but the aunt handed him the snuff box, passing it across Helena's back. Helena stooped forward to make room, and looked round with a smile. She was, as always at evening parties, wearing a dress such as was the then fashionable, cut very low at front and back. Her bust, which had always seemed like marble to Pierre, was so close to him that his short-sighted eyes could not but perceive the living charm of her neck and shoulders, so near to his lips that he need only have bent his head a little to have touched them. He was conscious of the warmth of her body, the scent of perfume, and the creaking of her corset as she moved. He did not see her marble beauty forming a complete whole with her dress, but all the charm of her body only covered by her garments. And having once seen this, he could not help being aware of it, just as we cannot renew an illusion we have once seen through. "So you have never before noticed how beautiful I am," Helena seemed to say. "You had not noticed that I am a woman. Yes, I am a woman who may belong to anyone, to you too," said her glance. And at that moment Pierre felt that Helena not only could, but must, be his wife, and that it could not be otherwise. He knew this at that moment as surely as if he had been standing at the altar with her. How and when this would be, he did not know. He did not even know if it would be a good thing. He even felt, he knew not why, that it would be a bad thing. But he knew it would happen. Pierre dropped his eyes, lifted them again, and wished once more to see her as a distant beauty, far removed from him, as he had seen her every day until then, but he could no longer do it. He could not, any more than a man who has been looking at a tuft of steppe grass through the mist and taking it for a tree, can again take it for a tree after he has recognized it to be a tuft of grass. She was terribly close to him. She already had power over him, and between them there was no longer any barrier except the barrier of his own will. "Well, I will leave you in your little corner," came Anna Pavlovna's voice. "I see you are all right there." And Pierre, anxiously trying to remember whether he had done anything reprehensible, looked round with a blush. It seemed to him that everyone knew what had happened to him as he knew it himself. A little later, when he went up to the large circle, Anna Pavlovna said to him, "I hear you are refitting your Petersburg house." This was true. The architect had told him it was necessary, and Pierre, without knowing why, was having his enormous Petersburg house done up. "That's a good thing, but don't move from Prince Vasily's. It is good to have a friend like the prince," she said, smiling at Prince Vasily. "I know something about that, don't I? And you are still so young. You need advice. Don't be angry with me for exercising an old woman's privilege." She paused, as women always do, expecting something after they have mentioned their age. "If you marry, it will be a different thing," she continued, uniting them both in one glance. Pierre did not look at Helena, nor she at him. but she was just as terribly close to him. He muttered something and coloured. When he got home, he could not sleep for a long time for thinking of what had happened. What had happened? Nothing. He had merely understood that the woman he had known as a child, of whom, when her beauty was mentioned, he had said absent-mindedly, "Yes, she is good-looking." He had understood that this woman might belong to him. "But she's stupid. I have myself said she is stupid," he thought. "There is something nasty, something wrong in the feeling she excites in me. I have been told that her brother Anatole was in love with her and she with him, that there was quite a scandal, and that's why he was sent away. Hippolyte is her brother. Prince Vasily is her father. It's bad," he reflected. But while he was thinking this, the reflection was still incomplete. He caught himself smiling and was conscious that another line of thought had sprung up, and while thinking of her worthlessness, he was also dreaming of how she would be his wife, how she would love him and become quite different, and how all he had thought and heard of her might be false. And he again saw her not as the daughter of Prince Vasily, but visualized her whole body, only veiled by its grey dress. But no, why did this thought never occur to me before? And again he told himself that it was impossible, and there would be something unnatural, and as it seemed to him dishonourable, in this marriage. He recalled her former words and looks, and the words and looks of those who had seen them together. He recalled Anna Pavlovna's words and looks when she spoke to him about his house, recalled thousands of such hints from Prince Vasily and others, and was seized by terror lest he had already in some way bound himself to do something that was evidently wrong, and that he ought not to do. But at the very time he was expressing this conviction to himself, in another part of his mind her image rose in all its womanly beauty. All right, there we have it. Another episode down. I do apologize for the background noise. The brothers Grimm, Launchpad members, Aiden and Cam, they rocked up and they said, "Oh, it's too hot. I just want to watch cartoons. I'm tired. Can we watch cartoons before we do any work?" And I said, "All right, guys, watch a couple of episodes before we do some worksheets, and I'm going to keep recording my podcast." They were happy with that. So I apologize for that. It was a really long chapter too, so I imagine the background noises got quite annoying. So we're back in peace times, back in Russia, I should say. And it's good to see Pierre and Prince Vasily and what they're up to. And the Prince Vasily has hung around Pierre, as has most people. Or at least they've made themselves known to him. Once you get a lot of money, if suddenly everyone's your friend and you can do no wrong. Now, Turtle Vader asked a really good question. Turtle Vader said, "Tolstoy all but spells out for us that Prince Vasily is not self-aware of his own plotting, instead instinctively controlling those around him to his own benefit. Does this make you admire or despise him? Do you feel the same way towards him as you feel towards Anna Mikhailovna the last time we saw her?" Personally, it makes me despise him a little bit. And I think the reason why is because, I mean, it's probably to some degree a human trait to, occasionally try to control situations to your benefit. But whenever we recognize that we're doing that, it's quite an ugly realization and you think, "Oh, no, I'm not really listening to other people's needs. I'm not respecting what they're trying to tell me," or that kind of thing. And I mean, I think any time that you despise the actions of someone else, it's a little bit because you see a little bit of like the worst of yourself in them, and it's not a pretty thing to see. Anna Mikhailovna, on the other hand, is a little bit more transparent in the way that she tries to work situations to her benefit. It's almost like she's playing the game without hiding the fact that she's playing the game. Who Was Once to Lie, it seems to agree. They said, "This makes me like him a great deal less. He is manipulative and opportunistic and not a bit self-reflective about it. After the plot with the Count's will, he'd have to be pretty myopic to not see himself as someone who would injure anyone for his own advantage." Myopic means nearsighted. "I'm not sure what it says about me that I prefer smart and manipulative, Anna Mikhailovna, to thoughtless, ignorant and manipulative, Vasily." You know, I think it's pretty fair to say that manipulative at all is bad. You know, any time that you feel like you've been manipulative, you're kind of horrified at your own actions. But to think that you could do it thoughtlessly is just a little bit eerier. Reddit user Original CJ5 thinks the opposite, though. They said, "This makes me feel a bit better for Prince Vasily. I almost started to despise him after his acts the last time we saw him at the Count's deathbed. Anna Mikhailova intentionally does what she does, while the Prince does things unintentionally, and that is good enough for me to start liking him again." I guess he can claim it to be an accident if it's unintentional, I suppose. But I don't think that it happening instinctually means it necessarily happens unintentionally. I think it's just that the intention is deeper within him, that he doesn't have to acknowledge it consciously. Another good question from Turtle Vader was, "Pierre finds himself seemingly swept off his feet with Helena, which he knows is just a mistake waiting to happen. Do you think he will continue to be manipulated, or will he, at some point, take control of his own life?" Original CJ5 said, "The business with Anna wooing Pierre towards Helena was very cunning, and I feel sorry for Pierre for falling into the trap. But from how she is described, I think that Helena is breathtakingly beautiful and good-natured and might be a good match for Pierre. It will be interesting to see how this proceeds." Yeah, I think he should follow his instincts are saying that he should marry Helena. He should follow his gut feeling that it's a bad idea. Original CJ5 mentioned that she is good-natured, but maybe I just haven't been paying attention enough, or I can't remember details about the character, but I kind of didn't get good-natured. I wouldn't say she was bad-natured, but she did seem a little bit, conceited, maybe. Who Was Once the Light said, "I think this question is pretty much going to be Pierre's story arc. I think he will eventually come into his own, but not in time to save himself from a bad marriage." I think that's a pretty fair call. I can definitely see an author finding a lot of good material in a situation like that, where a guy marries before he figures himself out and makes a bad decision. And just from a writing standpoint, there's more interesting stuff to work with there than him marrying well and being happy and content with his life. Well, I'll keep it short because the rest of this episode was quite long. It's good to be back in Russia. Pierre, I think Pierre's maybe my favorite character. Him or the name escapes me now. Dolokhov, the guy that drinks rum on the balcony and all the rest. The swashbuckler. But it is good to check back in with Pierre and see what's going on in Russia. Thank you once again for listening. If you would be so kind as to share this podcast around, and the Reddit community as well, please do so. It makes a big difference and a big help, and I do really appreciate it. All right, that's it for today. I will see you tomorrow.